The Agriculture and Rural Development Committee to order for Monday, February 4th. Today we have a few confirmations in front of us, as well as our first ag-related bill. Let the record state that a quorum is present. I think we'll begin by hearing from Dr. Holly Neaton, the Board of Animal Health. If you'd like to come to the witness stand, and please tell us a little bit about yourself and... Welcome to the committee, Doctor.
Hi. Thank you for having me. I'm a veterinarian from Watertown, Minnesota. And this would be, if you approve, would be my third term on the Board of Animal Health. I thank you for the support you've given to the Board of Animal Health in the past and hope you continue to support it in the future as much as you can. I think you're all aware of how important the animal. I don't know how much you want me to say. So,
Doctor, just feel free to. I mean, members too. Just so you know, in the packet, there's a letter from the governor and doctor's application. But I just want to tell us a little bit about your past and maybe how you enjoyed spending time on the Board of Animal Health.
Okay.
And then we'll ask members if they have any questions.
Sure. I think you're all aware, hopefully, how important it is to keep our animals healthy in the state of Minnesota. Not only the livestock animals, but our companion animals, wildlife, and how intimately that's connected with the health and well-being of the people, not only rural, but urban, suburban. And I think our Board of Animal Health, thanks to Dr. Bill Hartman and his crew, are one of the best in the country. And they do an excellent job. I'm proud to have served on it in the past. One thing that I really do, it's for other selfish reasons, I really enjoy the collaboration and the work that they do with the other agencies that have stakes in keeping our animals healthy. At our board meetings, we have representatives from the Department of Agriculture, Department of Health, College of Veterinary Medicine, the Diagnostic Lab, and all work together well to meet the goals, and that's to prevent diseases the ones that pass between humans and animals, keep our food safe, and also keep our livestock farmers their financial health. I specialize in food animals, mostly sheep and goats, which is kind of unique. They have their own little unique features, and there aren't many people on the board who also do that. So I hope, and I also work with many medical device companies, and so it's kind of bring a little unique. So I would very much enjoy to be. I would like to be on the board one more year or one more term, if you approve.
Thank you very much, Doctor. Are there any questions from committee members? If not, Senator Bonhoff moves the confirmation of Dr. Holly Neaton to the Board of Animal Health to the Senate floor with recommendation to confirm. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? No. The motion prevails. Thank you very much,
Thank
Doctor.
Thank you very much.
Next on the agenda, we're going to hear from Commissioner Tilson with the Bureau of Mediation Services. So, Commissioner, if you'd like to come forward and visit with the committee, we'd be honored to have you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thanks for having me here today to consider my confirmation. I'm proud to have been named as Commissioner of the Bureau of Mediation Services by Governor Dayton. We're known, as I think you know, by the acronym BMS. This is kind of a big occasion for me. I wanted to get my family down here, but I couldn't. I've been doing this for 25 years, and for 25 years they put up with me being gone long days and nights, many times overnight, traveling, you know, up and down and across the state of Minnesota in the service of labor relations peace. So. I really want to particularly thank my wife, Faith, and my kids, because they really have put up with a heck of a lot over these years while I've been doing this. It's also appropriate for me to recognize the dedicated men and women who do the day-to-day work of BMS. promoting workplace peace and stability. BMS is nearly anonymous. I know that there are several people. I did have the opportunity to visit with all of you, and I'm sure there are several of you who wondered who the heck we were when I walked into your office. BMS is a nearly anonymous agency. It's the smallest cabinet-level agency, and still, due to our broad jurisdiction, which covers virtually every part of state and local government, BMS mediators have an impact that far exceeds their small numbers. I'm not going to take up – I didn't write a long-winded speech, but I'd like to talk about three things real quickly that I think are important about what BMS does. It'll take me about 6 or 7 minutes. I hope you'll have patience with it, and if you have questions after that, I'd love to answer them. I want to talk about three things. First of all, public service, labor relations, and conflict resolution, because that's what we do at the BMS. Public service, I've given a lot of thought to because I've been doing this for a long time. I've been a public service servant for 25 years. I've worked as a labor mediator, a hearing officer, a manager, and for the last 2 years, as I said, I've been the commissioner of BMS. When I was a new mediator in 1988, I was fortunate to come under the tutelage and instruction of some great professionals who served the people of Minnesota and governors from Orville Freeman to Rudy Perpich. And I want to acknowledge their names right here because they're just great people who nobody really is going to remember other than the folks who work with them. But Commissioners Paul Goldberg and Peter Obermeyer, State Negotiator Lance Teachworth and Commissioner Lance Teachworth, John Kaderka, who was a mediator and a state negotiator for many years, Murray Perry and Pat Harrington, all these folks are now gone from state service. A number of them have passed away. But these are the folks that really, you know, laid the foundations and really taught me about what it means to be a public servant. So I think the thing that they really taught me was that that public service is an honor and a responsibility, but that it's also essential to democracy. I tried to put it in a little phrase that I try to sort of stick on my wall, and it is this: that public policy and its administration bring together sharply competing interests. We've seen that in public life all too much lately. And it falls to public servants to make real and breathe life into the decisions of lawmakers and reconcile the competing interests as intended by elected representatives of the people. Experience has taught us over the years that this can best be done through rational rules-based policies and procedures that are neutrally and uniformly enforced. The alternative is favoritism, chaos, and instability. People call it pejoratively bureaucracy. They call it pejoratively bureaucracy. But it's really public service. That's what it is. It's public service. And the people who do it are dedicated, hardworking, honest, and deserve our thanks. So that's my thing on public service. On labor relations, few people in our society today know much about labor relations. The history of labor relations between employers and unions in the U.S. is well known, and it's steeped in turmoil. And I'm not going to try to recite it here. But instead, I want to give my view that the rights of employees or workers to choose whether to organize themselves in groups for collective representation is a cornerstone of the long-term stability and success of our system. People organizing themselves into groups for common purpose are the basic building blocks of civilization. Think companies, churches, professional organizations, civic groups. Our economy itself is structured around commercial enterprises, large and small, that are really groups of people organized for their own economic self-interest. No less legitimate is the right of individual citizens who work for a wage to voluntarily organize in collective bargaining groups for the purpose of representing their own self-interest. Aspects of this system are widely misunderstood, and I want to talk about one for a minute. It's the principle of exclusive representation, because I think it's quite controversial. To have meaningful bargaining power, a group of employees may have only one representative at a time. If you imagine a single group of employees with numerous bargaining representatives and where individual employees can also bargain their own terms and conditions of employment, you can imagine the chaos that results. And prior to the advent of modern labor relations laws, this was the prevailing condition, and effective collective bargaining was impossible. Under this system, most employee groups were able to aggregate any bargaining authority. Under our current system, they do. Along with the right to be an exclusive representative comes a responsibility for the unions. It's known as the duty of fair representation, or DFR. DFR is the legal obligation of a union or an exclusive representative to represent all the employees in their bargaining group fairly, in good faith, and without discrimination. This system is far from perfect, but has played an important role in creating the U.S. middle class and in representing its economic interests since the Depression over the last 75 years. So finally, let me just say a couple of words about conflict resolution. It's a cliche that conflict is an everyday part of life, but the field of conflict resolution for me personally has been highly rewarding all these years I've been doing it. Mediators are peacemakers, they're problem solvers, they're professionals, and they're trained in the art and science of helping people in conflict find a path to agreement. Be it the purchase of a used car, dispute between a neighbor, neighbors over a barking dog, where to have dinner with your family, a labor agreement, or the state budget itself, each of these cases, people have a problem to solve, a disagreement, a negotiation, or a conflict. In alternative dispute resolution theory, we think of conflict in terms of the interests that the parties have in common and the interests that are in conflict. The skill of a mediator resides in taking advantage of solutions that address as many of both parties' common interests as possible. Mediation begins with the decision to talk about shared problems. It is the sum of all the tools and skills of creative problem solving. The techniques rely on genuine communication, effective listening, step-by-step problem solving, and shared decisions about action. A key ingredient to analyzing conflict is weighing the importance of relationships against the importance of the substance of any particular conflict. For example, if you're buying a used car, the things that are important are the price and the warranty. What's not important, what's less important, is the relationship with the between the parties. On the other hand, when you're trying to decide where to eat dinner with your family, your relationship's the most key ingredient, and where you eat probably is less important to you. So when the two sides of a negotiation have a high interest in the relationship and a high interest in the substance of the issue, the climate is ripe for creative and collaborative problem solving. In public sector labor relations, labor management relations, the parties have a long-term relationship, and they, because they will negotiate contracts year after year and cycle after cycle. They are evaluated by the public as a single unit. An acrimonious relationship makes for an unpleasant place to work and an unproductive workforce. This leads to poor work product and dissatisfied customers, which in our case is citizens. For this reason, intelligent and enlightened labor management relations paired with modern problem-solving and conflict resolution are good for Minnesota public employers, their employees, and the public they serve. The last thing I want to say is that in a 1999 speech to a sheet metal workers union, Paul Wellstone coined the phrase, "We all do better when we all do better." And this is nowhere more true than when applied to labor management relations. What a mediator likes to say is it's a good bargain that when it benefits both sides. And that's what we strive for and what we do. It's not always possible. It can often be a nasty business, but we're proud to be doing it. So sorry if I was a little long-winded, but I wanted to tell you guys what we do and what I think about it. I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Thank you, Commissioner. And no, I'm glad that you took time to discuss this, because while your department's not that big, I think the work that you do there is very important. It serves the entire state quite well. So I know that I enjoyed the time that we spoke together in my office, and I think you met with many of the other members too. So thank you for what you do. Are there any questions from the members for Commissioner?
Comment?
Senator Bono.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I just want to echo the same, that I wasn't familiar with your agency and the critical role you have played, not just in our most recent negotiations, but for many years. So thanks for your service.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you. Okay, members, if there's no other questions, then Senator Schmidt moves the confirmation of Josh Tielson as Commissioner of the Bureau of Mediation Services to the Senate floor with recommendations to confirm. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, no. The motion prevails. Thank you very much, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much, and committee members, for the opportunity to present Senate File 113 to you this afternoon. I do have, before we get started, Mr. Chair, an author's amendment, the A1 amendment, that would put the bill in the shape that I would prefer. I think that amendment's coming around, or you should have it soon. Thank you. Mr. Chairman, maybe counsel can help me. Maybe it's basically, this is just some clarifying language of one reference that we just wanted to have changed to match the House language. So whenever the committee members are comfortable, I would move the A1 author's amendment.
Is there a second on that motion? Don't need a second. Okay. Any discussion on the motion? All right. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Nay? Any opposed? Say nay. All right. The motion's adopted.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. And today we're going to talk a little bit about drainage and the work group. I would like to sit here and take credit for it. I have carried this bill in the past, but I can tell you that this is the purpose of this is to make some changes to the drainage laws. And this drainage work group has been meeting since 2006 and has done a wonderful job. I think in your handouts you'll see, and I'm not going to read through it because you can see it, but anytime that we start talking drainage issues, they can become very contentious. But this group that meets together with drainage authorities, farm groups, environmental groups, and other associations and universities, state agencies, and the legislature have worked very hard to make sure that they do that work diligently and come forward with these consensus agenda items. And so with that, Mr. Chair, I'm going to turn it over to the chief engineer from the Board of Soil and Water Resources, Al Keene, to walk you through the bill, and then we'll certainly answer any questions that you may have.
Thank you, Senator. And Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Al Keene. I serve as chief engineer for the Board of Water and Soil Resources and also serve as a facilitator for the Stakeholder Drainage Work Group. And as Senator Sparks indicated, we've been meeting for a number of years now. This is the third batch of recommendations, consensus recommendations, for updates of Minnesota drainage law. And there's four primary components of these recommendations. One of them is to provide a clear process for reestablishment of drainage system records that are either lost, destroyed, or otherwise incomplete. The drainage authorities have been doing some of this over the years, but it wasn't crystal clear exactly how to do that. So what this recommendation does is provide clarity and consistency for how drainage authorities, counties, watershed districts would work to reestablish drainage system records that, again, are lost, destroyed, or incomplete. Number two, primary focus of this is on clarifying the transfer of drainage system records. Watershed districts have authority to take over, if you will, Chapter 103E drainage systems, transfers from counties, and as part of that, then they need records for those systems. But oftentimes there is a need for both counties and watershed districts to have records for the same systems. If there's an overlap, if you will, not really an overlap, but a coordination of authority. If, for example, a portion of a drainage system is transferred, then both the watershed district and the county need a copy of those records. It wasn't clear in drainage law how to transfer the records, and it wasn't clear if there was an ability to have duplicate records that were authenticated. So this recommendation provides for a clear definition of transfer between a county and a watershed district. It also provides then for a way to have an authenticated copy if both of those drainage authorities need a set of those records. A third part of what this consensus recommendations, this bill provides for, is clarifying some authority within two provisions of drainage law, both section 227, which is impounding, rerouting, and diversion of drainage system waters, and in section 103E701, which is the repairs section. So there's a clarification of drainage authority, ability to include wetland and water quality improvement elements in projects under those two sections. That was a recommendation that came forth through the LCCMR project that was done by Smith Partners for evaluation of drainage law evaluation and analysis. So that was one of the recommendations from their report that the drainage work group is endorsing the adoption of. The fourth primary element of this bill is to provide for a multi-stage ditch cross-section under a repair, petitioned repair. Under the current law, the drainage authorities are obliged to return an existing cross-section of a ditch back to the original trapezoidal section. And in some cases, it may make sense to adopt a two-stage, for example, ditch cross-section, where Mother Nature has carved a low-flow channel within a otherwise trapezoidal ditch. And in order to reduce future maintenance, in order to retain potential aquatic habitat that has developed in that ditch cross-section, a two-stage ditch may be the right thing to do. The current law isn't clear that it enables that to occur. So the recommendations from the work group are to modify the petitioned repair section and the definition of repair very slightly to enable a multi-stage ditch cross-section to be utilized by a drainage authority if the engineer's report recommends that to be done. So again, these primary ones are about updates of drainage law. There's several definitions that correspond to these four primary areas that are also being recommended to clarify and to update. With that, Mr. Chairman, members, I would be open to any questions you have about the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Kane. Any questions among the members? Yes, Senator Weber.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just looking at Subdivision 6 on the bill, page 5, and it talks about wetland restoration and replacement, water quality protection and improvement. I'm assuming that under brand-new projects nowadays, that is an automatic part of the requirements. Now, this says that it may be included, but I assume there's no requirement that an existing project that's in need of repair has to go back and comply with those provisions? Would that be a safe assumption?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, this clarification is, first of all, if you'll note in the title where it said mitigation, that really is more correctly stated as a replacement,
correct,
because it's not mitigating an impact, if you will. It's the ability to provide for replacement of a wetland that may be impacted by a repair. So this is under the repair section, 701, and to provide clarity that a water quality protection or improvement reason for that is a legitimate reason for that wetland restoration or protection. So again, it's a clarification. It's not a new authority,
okay,
if you will.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Kane. Any other questions? Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Down.
And if you could tell me, sir, this cross-section that you're talking about in a drainage ditch, two different stages, could you explain that a little more thorough? That I'm not quite understanding where you're going there.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I think the easiest way to think about this is if you've seen a ditch or a stream where there's a low-flow channel that at the bottom of the cross-section, and over time, that low-flow channel is maybe a meandering channel down through the bottom of an otherwise trapezoidal or rectangular-shaped cross-section. And it really is a reflection oftentimes of there being perennial low-flow. If there's low-flow in that channel most all of the time, nature is going to tend to want to carve that low-flow channel down through the cross-section. This provision enables a drainage authority to essentially adopt that cross-section or possibly to create then a cross-section that has that low-flow channel. It also has in it a little higher elevation, a bench elevation, a little wider channel, so that, in fact, the hydraulic capacity would be the same as the original ditch cross-section. So that's the provision in the definition of repair that we've tweaked. And it would enable then the ditch authority to adopt what may well be a more stable cross-section that will require less maintenance in the future. And if that low-flow channel has substantial aquatic habitat, for them to keep that, if you will, rather than completely excavating the channel out again and having it reform over time.
Thank you.
Any other questions, members? Seeing no questions, we have a motion.
Mr. Chairman, thank you for the questions. And again, I want to just thank the Drainage Work Group for doing a lot of the heavy lifting on this. But if there's no further discussion, then I would move that Senate File 113 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor. There's no fiscal note, so I think it can go directly to the floor.
I assume. Environment.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sparks, in the past, drainage bills have generally gone to Ag as the committee of origination, but then they've gone to Environment in the past. Now, I don't know if you've heard from the Environment Committee if they want to see this or not, but in the past, we have something to both committees.
Okay. That's helpful. Thank you, Mr. Cobb.
We haven't heard from the Environment Committee. They haven't requested the bill, so...
Okay. I will certainly talk with the chair of that committee, but I think if they want to have it re-referred there, we can do it. But I think at this point, let's just – I would renew my motion that Senate File 113 is amended to be recommended to pass and sent to the Senate floor.
Do we need a second? No second. All right. All those in favor of the motion before us, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
And those opposed, no. With that, we have passage of Senate File 113 to the floor. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members.
And with that, that concludes our committee for today. We'll be back at the call of the chair. Thank you.
That's okay. I don't know. All right. Got the record.